I realize that quite a few of those words are not things that are anywhere resembling in the title of the conference or the title of anybody else's talk. So I'll do my best to try to convince you that either you should be interested in them, or if not, at least then you can say a few things about quantum computation in some sort of dinner conversation when you want to sound official about something else. But and I threw in an effort to keep people interested for a little bit longer, I threw in words that might be slightly more, which are relevant and might be slightly more familiar, say. So I guess I have this multimedia dual projector thing. I should probably use it, but I'm not sure if I... Oh. Okay, so let me just give you a brief outline of what to anticipate, so you can, if it's becoming painful, you'll know where in the pain you are listening. But I'm going to do a brief introduction to quantum computation, because I'm assuming that most of you don't know too much about that. Tell you a little bit about tensor networks. Then I'm going to tell you the result, which is sort of the main focus of this, which is sort of a view of a quantum computer as an approximator of tensor networks. And then I'll go to examples, and those are when all these nice words come in, which are examples of tensor networks that a quantum computer can approximate. And the last part is audience participation, because there's sort of I guess I'll just allude to it now, but there's the result has to do with an algorithm that approximates some quantities. And it is extremely unclear whether that approximation is useful. There is some evidence that's kind of there's evidence that it is useful in the sense that it's all a quantum computer can do. But at the same time, it might not be useful for the kinds of things that you might want to compute out of these things. So I'll get to it more later. But the audience participation part was the dream is that somebody says, oh, that was just what I would need. That's just the approximation I would need to do something interesting. So anyway. So if you feel like making me feel better, that's what you should say at some point. Okay. So let's start with a little brief introduction to quantum computation. So quantum computation is a model of computation involving, if you had a quantum computer, how you'd do it. So your sort of starting point is, this is kind of a hybrid presentation of the computer science and operator algebra view of these things. You start with a finite dimensional vector space H, and with a prescribed basis on it, orthonormal basis. And here's what you can do. You start with a fixed vector, let's say x1 tensor x1, in the tensor product of H, some number of copies, n copies. And here's what you're allowed to do. You're allowed to apply local unitaries, and by local I mean you don't want to apply a unitary, well here I've just said on two copies, which is sort of enough. You can sort of string two copies together anywhere you want, and you can apply a local unitary to move this particular vector around, right? Still going to be a unit vector since they're unitaries. And then once you're done doing the prescribed series of unitaries that you get to pick, then you can measure the results, and I have to tell you what measuring the result means. And measuring the result. So after you've applied all these unitaries, you have some vector that you're left with in this n to the, or d to the n dimensional space. Right? So you're left with this vector. You've applied the unitaries to this particular vector. You're left with this vector with all a bunch of coefficients. And when you measure, you say to the quantum computer, go measure. And what it does is it spits out a set of indices, i1 through in, corresponding to xi1 through xin. And it spits that one out with probability proportional to the square of the size of the coefficient. So the sum of those squares add up to 1 because it's a unit vector. So that's what it does. So the whole game of quantum computation is to somehow encode the answer to your problem in such a way so that with high probability what comes out tells you the answer to the problem. So you want your vectors to have all of its all the coefficients concentrated in some place that answers your question for you. Okay, so that is the model for quantum computation. And so let's see. So there's this might be an appropriate moment. There's a comedian, Guido Sarducci, you know, the five-minute university thing? Am I dating myself? Anybody know the five-minute university routine? So I can do a false Italian accent worse than he can, but he talks about the five-minute university, where I will teach you in 5 minutes everything you will remember from college 5 years after you've graduated. And he goes through the whole thing. He has sort of a little intercession. He has exams. And for instance, for economics or something like that, it's the when you're tested for economics, the answer is supply and demand. And for Spanish, it's como está usted, muy bien. And so it sort of goes on like that. But anyway, so the version of that for the graduate course in quantum computation is the following. So the quantum computer can do anything a classical computer can do, as fast. Oh, I should say, well, I'll say that in a second, about what fast means. A quantum computer can factor quickly, and if you want to be very impressive, you can mention that's a result of Shor's. And if you want to be more impressive, you can say how, well, you know, our whole banking system and internet system is built on RSA, and if you could factor quickly, well, then that would all collapse and lead to sort of some sort of feudal society, which would happen. And whereas as soon as they get panicky about that, you can tell them that, no, you can't buy one. So it's not going to happen anytime soon. Quantum computers for that kind of scale of thing have not been built, and it is debatable about whether they will ever be built, though you don't want to mention that to funding agencies if you're trying to do anything. So there's one thing here that quickly, for instance, and what does that mean, quickly? And so I should sort of say, right, so the speed of an algorithm for doing things corresponds to the number of unitaries that you need to apply before measuring, and as a function of n. So things are considered efficient if they're not exponential in n, but polynomial in n. Okay, let's see. I suppose if this is the level of talk, the level of knowledge that you want to come away with, I should probably put this up so you can, we'll have a short exam at the end in that second. Okay, so that completes quantum computation. And so now let me tell you about tensor networks, which go into, I think, a lot of other names that I don't know. So anybody want to tell me them, that's fine. So what are tensor networks? Well, you've got, let me give you the ingredients for them. You've got a graph, G, floating around, and let's call E of G the edges of the graph. And I want to single out a special graph just for notational reason, which is for any vertex, GV will just be the subgraph consisting, it's just the star. It's just all edges that are connected to that particular vertex. Okay, so it's just, they all look the same. They're just stars with the however many edges coming out as the valence of V. And by labeling of a graph will be, you'll have some sort of fixed index set of size k, and a labeling will be put on every edge of the graph a number from 1 to k. Okay, so there are plenty of labelings of things. Okay, and a tensor is associated to a vertex of a graph. And it, what it is it's a map. So here's my vertex. Okay, it's a map from the set of labelings to the complex numbers. Okay, so what it means is that whenever I label the vertex, out shoots a number. Okay. So here I've labeled the edges, 1, 5, 4, 6, and 2, right? And for that labeling, it has the associated number minus 14, just an example. Right? And then I would have to assign labels for everything else. Okay. Okay. So this tensor determines a whole bunch of linear maps. Okay. Essentially, so all the edges that go into this vertex V, you can partition them into any two sets. Okay, call those sets E1 and E2. In this case, we took the left 3, that'll be E1, and the right 2 will be 2. And so I want to describe a linear map that goes from 3 copies of H, the tensor product of 3 copies of H, to 2 copies of H, just from what had happened before. And it's completely determined by these linear expressions. So the inner product, right, of the MV acting on this basis element, x1 tensor, x2 tensor, x6, should have inner product with the basis element, x5 tensor, x4. This lies in 2 copies of H. This lies in 3 copies of H. The inner product of that should be what you get by putting these labels, 1, 2, 6, 5, and 4, around on this thing and what MV spits out, which was minus 14 from the last picture. Okay, so this determines, so I can, just by specifying this data, it's kind of like then I can divide up these spaces in all kinds of different ways, and they're all kinds of different linear maps. Is that clear? Yeah? Not too bad? Okay, so we've got a graph, we've got a tensor on the, we've got a sort of labeling, we have got sort of a dimension of the space, K, that we label, and then we've got these tensors. And so a tensor network is a graph with a tensor associated to each of the graph elements, each of the vertices. And the value of the tensor is this, which is, all right, so maybe I should draw a graph of something, and then that would be a little bit. These do not have to be planar graphs. I know that's, well, regardless, I have a terrible time not trying to draw non-planar graphs, even if I want to. But I know it's also sacrilege to talk about non-planar things. But so you have a graph, and you have tensors associated to each of these vertices, and this value of the tensor network is sort of what, you know, in planar algebra is the partition function or whatever. You want to sum over all possible labelings of the graph. And once you've labeled the graph with a particular labeling, you sum over all possible labelings. So here's a particular labeling, let's say. Then at each vertex, there's a number that pops out, right? Because now this is a tensor, and it's all of its adjacent things are labeled. So there's a number binary. You multiply all those numbers together, and then you sum over all possible labelings. You get a big number out of it. So that's the value, what we'll call the value of the tensor network. So that's what I mean here. This is sum over the all labels L, and MV of L, what I'll mean by that is you take the labeling of just around V that L induces, and you take the value of MV associated to that, and you multiply those all together. Okay, so we're almost to the point of, I can tell you what the another view of quantum computing to tell you a little bit more about negotiating through tensor networks. I have to tell you what a bubbling of a tensor network is. And a bubbling of a tensor network is you just imagine that you have a bubble, and this is sort of exactly, for those of you who know planar algebras and the original sort of proof that planar algebras do what they want to do, it's the same exact same notion, which is you start with a bubble that is somewhere, not connected to anything, and this bubble's getting hungry and it starts to swallow one vertex at a time. Okay, so we can choose which vertex it swallows, and we can, if it's, you know, it doesn't have to be attached to itself, so it can decide that it wants to take another piece of its bubble and move over here and do something. But for instance, I can, an example of a bubbling would be I start like this, and then I go and I swallow this vertex, and then maybe I come along and I swallow that one, right? And then maybe I want to swallow this one over here, so I could either do that by coming all the way around and swallowing it, or I could go around by starting a new one of my little, what's that called? What do amoebas do? They bud? Is that what they do? Yeah. So I could start over here. And whenever I get to a point where if I have more than one bubble, if they ever, so let me continue. And if the bubbling, the next bubbling was to swallow this one from over here, at that point, because these share an edge, they would merge together. But anyway, a bubbling is you could just think of it as a sequence, a pre-specified sequence of ways of going through these vertices. Okay? That's what a bubbling is. So there are plenty of bubblings for a given tensor network. And the reason I'm talking about this is I want to give you, I want to tell you about a parameter associated to the bubbling. And the parameter associated to the bubbling is as follows. Oh, shoot. Anyways, I better just start again. So I'll start with a new one. I'll start with a simpler graph. Okay, suppose that's the graph. So here I am, I'm going to bubble this guy first. And for each node I get, as I bubble, I think of the before and after of the bubbling. So before I was here and after I ended up swallowing this. And the before and the after divide up the edges that lead to this vertex into things that were crossed before and things that were crossed afterwards. So in this case, nothing had been crossed before, and both edges are crossed afterwards. Right? If I now extend over from here to here, right? Before, I've already crossed this edge, and after, by the time after, I pick up the other edge. Right? So by the time I'm done swallowing a vertex, I've swallowed all the edges, and depending on when I start, I have some of the edges that I've half swallowed before that. Okay? And so remember how to each vertex there was a map, there were a whole bunch of linear maps, right? And I look at the linear map that corresponds to the before and after of the edge swallowing. So in this case, the linear map would be from zero copies of H, which is just constant, to two copies of H. Right, this is if V0. This is V0. And in this case, it would be the map from one from H to H. Okay, does that make sense? Depending on how I swallow, it picks out a different one of these maps based on how many edges were crossed before I started and how many edges were crossed afterwards. It divides them up into two pieces, and that's what it does. And so each of these maps have a norm, and they're not the same. So maybe I should make sure you understand that. So if I have a tensor that we would think of as corresponding to the identity. So the tensor corresponding to the identity would be something there. If I label both sides by the same color, then you get one. And if I label it by where k is not equal to l, the value of my tensor would be zero, for instance. Okay, that's a very simple tensor. Right? And it has, if I'm swallowing, so, or this tensor induces two maps, it induces a map, well, three actually, but it induces a map from H to H, and it induces a map from C to H tensor H. Right? And the map from H to H is genuinely the identity, and the map from C to H tensor H sends, you know, the number one to the summation of XL tensor XL. Okay? I should have probably given you that example beforehand. Right? And the consequence of that is if you look at the norm of this map, it's norm 1. And if you look at the norm of this map, it's norm square root of the dimension, I think, or the dimension. I always get those confused, but I think it's the square root of the dimension. So a tensor, depending on how you swallow it, can have very different norms. Right? So the bubbling determines which map for each of the tensors to use, and you take the norm on each of these maps and you multiply those all together, and that's what we'll call delta of a bubbling. Okay, so in this case, order really does matter. Right? There may be hidden in here a very good ordering that or different ordering that makes these things bigger or small. Okay, so. There's been a sort of typhoon over here. Okay. Okay, so here's the theorem. And the theorem ends up being a characterization of what a quantum computer can and can't do. Okay, so the theorem says, given a tensor network and a bubbling B, its value can be approximated within, and this is additively approximated, within a factor of epsilon times this parameter, delta sub B, in time that's considered efficient, polynomial in 1 over epsilon and the number of edges. Yeah. Delta sub B, that was what I just... it's the product. Did I not say that? Ooh, okay. It's the product of the norms of each of the pieces that you get as you're bubbling. Each of the maps figured. Okay, so this is sort of an abstract theorem. It says, hey, this is something that a quantum computer can do. So that's not interesting until I can give you interesting examples of tensor networks, right? And that still may not be interesting because this level of approximation might be something like that you say, it's completely useless to me. You know, when I actually do this for any problem that I want, I might as well just have guessed zero, because zero is as close as anything. You know, this parameter is so big that to make this parameter small, I have to make epsilon exponentially large in the size of the problem, in which case now we're talking about it a very long time, too long. Okay, so the partial answer to this and I'll sort of hammering in a couple different times, is that, okay, sure, it's not useful to you, but it's also all that a quantum computer can do. Okay, this is a complete problem for quantum computation. So you can safely, in a more advanced inner conversation, toss off that all it can do is approximate tensor networks. Okay, well, it's like, well, what good is quantum computation? All it can do is approximate, because that is all it can do. You can prove that this is a complete problem. So implicitly what that means is that there is and explicitly, I suppose, if you really wanted to work at it, is that, for instance, there is some tensor network that you can set up whose evaluation will tell you how to factor a number. Because we know quantum can factor. Of course, we don't know whether classical can factor, but I should have maybe said that at some point. But nobody knows how to do it. Okay, so what I want to do now is, is give you some examples. So examples of tensor networks. So the first example that I want to give you is the Jones polynomial. So there were results by Friedman, Kataev, Wang, and Larson that sort of presented quantum computation as in sort of TQFT computational world, which implied that both that there was an algorithm for computing the Jones polynomial and that this was a complete problem. And then that was made, that algorithm was made explicit by Voronoff, Jones, and me. But this was an algorithm at particular points, and now this sort of corresponds, this is a sort of bigger thing that covers the Jones polynomial anyway, but the idea remains the same from that particular setup, and the idea is to take, the idea is to take the Jones polynomial, translate it to a temporally Lieb calculation, and then realize this calculation is a tensored network using the path model. So you turn the Jones polynomial calculation into a temporally Lieb calculation, and then you represent it. And so maybe I should say a little bit of something about how that works, and I'll just sort of highlight little pieces of it. So first of all, for the for the Jones, for the calculation of the Jones polynomial up to some ride factor, it was described by sort of these Kaufman kind of setup, where you replace every crossing by some linear combination of these two pictures. So you take a so the Jones polynomial, by the way, is it's a polynomial associated to links, and so you take a link diagram and you translate it into a temporally Lieb element by replacing every crossing by a linear combination of these two things, and with the appropriate parameters, and then eventually you have a sum of a series of temporally Lieb diagrams, but they're all closed up. Right? So the original thing was a link, so you've got everything closed up, so you've got these sort of nested loops, and for each picture you pull out b to the number of loops. So you can embed this picture in the as a sum of temporally Lieb calculations. Now you might say, well, okay, but I know how to calculate temporally Lieb things are pretty easy. If I show you a picture of a bunch of loops, I know exactly what the value of that is, right? That's just b to the number of loops, right? And the point is here that every time you take a crossing, you create a sum of two things. And so if you have n crossing, you end up getting a sum of 2 to the n things. And so indeed, you can do this calculation by hand, but the time it takes is 2 to the n. That's no good. It's too big, too long, exponential in the input of the problem. Okay, so you've now got it as represented. So instead of representing it as a sum of two things, we just, you know, represent it as something in the temporally Lieb algebra with a hidden box, and the box has in it these two things, right? And so now we want to talk, so now we have a genuine computation that we want to do in the temporally Lieb algebra, which is replaced every one of these crossings with a box, and I want to do that calculation. So I have to turn that calculation into a calculation of a tensor network, right? And so I'm going to delay explaining that, how to turn it into a tensor network, until example 3, which is sort of a more general version of this. So just hold that thought. And let me give you the second example. So the second example is the Q-state Potts model. So the Potts model is a statistical physics model that I profess to only vaguely understanding why people like it so much, but that's my ignorance. But I can describe the model to you, which is as follows. You have a, usually people think of it about as a lattice of sites, but it doesn't need to be, just any kind of graph of sites. And one way you think of each of these vertices as in one of Q states. So you think of, you can color each of the vertices by one of Q colors, and for each edge you fill in, there's a parameter W of Q and Q prime that only depends on whether the colors are the same or different. Okay, if they're the same, it spits out one number. If they're different, it spits out another number. And then the quantity that you're interested in, that sort of is a normalizing parameter that sort of is important for all these things, is summing over all possible colorings of the vertices. You sum over all possible colorings of the vertices, and what do you do with for any individual coloring of the vertices? You've got these weights that show up. You multiply all those weights together, and you add up the whole thing. Okay, so that's very reminiscent of this tensor network, but it's a little bit different because in this case, your colorings are vertices, right? And you're kind of the things that the numbers that were popped up are popping up out of edges, right? And so all I have to do is describe to you the dual picture, which will create. We'll make the edges vertices and the vertices something. Right? And so that picture actually is just the following. So let me just translate that picture directly into a tensor network. I keep the old vertices that were there, and I add, and they all become of one type. And then I add a new special vertex in the middle of every, so this will be a different vertex in the middle of every one. And let me describe the tensors for the two types of vertices. So there's circle vertices and there're X vertices, right? So this is something that you could get some satisfaction doing on your own, which is that these vertices, what do they want to make sure? What we're going to do is translate the colors from the vertices to the edges. So what we're going to do is make this a tensor that insists that anything that comes into it is labeled by the same color. Okay? So the vertices are going to just spit out a 1 if the edges all around it are labeled by the same color, and a 0 if not. Right? So that's one tensor. And then we have this tensor which encodes these weights, and this tensor looks and says, hey, if the colors on both sides of me are the same, I spit out one number, and if the colors are different, I spit out another number. Okay? So everybody see, so then how this, now that's a tensor network. I've doubled the number of nodes, or approximately doubled the number of nodes. There are two different kinds of nodes. There's one node that is essentially just the identity, though if it's on more things, it's a little unclear what that means. And then there's another one that sort of just encodes the interactions between them and has. Okay. So that's for the Q-state POTS model. And so then I promised to come back to the Jones polynomial, and I'll do that through planar algebras coming from a bipartite graph. If you want to, so in this case, I have to tell you a little bit about, I guess, that planar algebra, which I think of as still in the old way with squares rather than circles, but which will only lead to more confusion to me and everybody else. But see if I can do this okay. So the idea here is that there's a planar algebra associated to a bipartite graph. Let's say, and the way it works is there's still the shading that goes on. Where's the other part that needs to be shaded? What happened here? Nobody stopped me. It's lonely, and it can't get to where it's going. Okay. How's that? All right. So here's my shading. And the shadings, so we label the shaded pieces and the unshaded pieces by one side or other sides of these. So a labeling of this, so I should say, around each of these is labeled is a path on this bipartite graph around each of these guys. And we evaluate this by, these types of pictures spit out numbers for any allowable path that would translate along this graph. And the way you evaluate this is you sum over all possible labelings of vertices in these guys, with the even vertices labeling the dark piece and the odd vertices labeling the white piece. And that sort of implicitly, as long as this is, you can add then labels along the edges which correspond to actual paths that join up vertices from the one to vertices of the other, and you sum over all possible labelings, and each of these guys spits out a number, and that's the value of the zero, that's the partition function, that's the value of the Kangol. And so now I have to convince you, so here, somehow, the vector space, I'll give you the brief version of what you need to do, which is you need to create nodes for every space that you have. So you have a node here, and a node here, and a node here, and there are more elsewhere. You keep these as vertices as well, and you connect them up. Let's see. There's another one here. Okay, so you get a dual picture that involves putting nodes in three places. One is in areas, two is where the original boxes were, and the third is, there's this extra consideration that you have to make at maxima and minima. So you have to put, I have to think of a third symbol, say a star, Okay? And then you connect them up based on what's adjacent to what. And then this allows your edges to be, so these tensors now check that they're listening, what they see as inputs is colors from their appropriate edges, and they check to make sure that the vertices that they see correspond to actually paths here, and they spit out the appropriate number. And these vertices just make sure that all the different places that it's attached to have the same color. So these vertices are a lot like the ones here, where all they're trying to do is ensure that the edges have the same color. And then you've got these third little vertices at maxima and minima, and those spit out the appropriate. They look at what's labeling, and they spit the appropriate factor for that. And so, let's see. So going back to realizing this is a path model, well, you know, the temporary lead is an example of this with the principal graph being AN or A in general. And you have to do a little extra work I guess there's a little extra work to be done because you want to insist that the leftmost one is labeled by some distinguished vertex. And let's see. So those were examples. There's another example, which is the top polynomial of a planar graph. And that goes via the same sort of basic philosophy as the Jones polynomial. Something that I should have said earlier, and I guess I can say now, is the philosophy of quantum computation is that unitaries are important. Unitary operators are important. I should have sort of gone back to that first, wherever that theorem slide is, right? What's interesting about that is that we're making no insistence on anything being unitary. Those unitaries are sort of gone from this picture. There is this parameter that shows up, but unitaries are gone from this picture. And that's, I think, both refreshing and a little bit surprising. When you look at the details, it's not so surprising, but from someone who's come to quantum computation somewhat late, the sort of philosophy that, you know, the golden thing is unitary operators and it all has to do with unitary operators is sort of pretty heavily in my brain, and the fact that you can formulate quantum computation without talking about unitaries is in this sort of pretty simple way is rather surprising. And I guess part of the hope, right, of this approach is that you're sort of I guess I should say, backing up, if you want to expand your dinner table conversation a little bit, which is that the Shor's algorithm for factoring is pretty much the main result in quantum computation. It's what's gotten the funding. It's what's gotten people interested. And there's been a lot of work put in subsequent to that with some very nice mathematical results, but no real results where anybody would say, wow. You know, no real results for other than factoring for problems that people would, and maybe maybe people would take issue with this a little bit, but where people really care about the answer. And so there's sort of been this buildup of excitement. Oh, quantum computing, it's going to do so many more wonderful things, of which they found one very nice thing that it can do. That's true. That's true. And I should say that's. There is a search that you can search a database in square root of the number of data point time. That's not an exponential speed up to what is otherwise known, but is certainly something that people would find useful. And so since that time, which was that result was 95, I think, not too much has gone around. So in terms of new algorithms for problems that people sort of would think of as being important. And so one of the hopes is somehow that this point of view will lead to real sort of something in statistical mechanics that you would really actually want to know. Right? And so as far as I can tell, I'm a sort of neophyte when it comes to statistical mechanical models and what they are. But as far as when anybody explains to me a particular model, it seems apparent that it can be realized as a tensor network. And so then the question just becomes the following, which is, okay, is this level of approximation useful? And this is where everybody else can help me out, right? And so again, I want to stress that there is an indirect answer to this question, and the indirect answer is it appears that it should be, because it's all that a quantum computer can do, and so in particular, you can use it to factor, which nobody around here knows how to do without a quantum computer, factor quickly. But that's not the same as saying, there's this question about distinguishing two knots, and if I just had a quantum computer, I could answer it. Right? There's sort of no example of that that we know of that's really sort of motivated by knots, where we know that the approximation scale is good enough for what we want to do. And I should say that I mentioned this a little bit earlier, but the big problem is complete, but also certain sub-problems of them are complete. If you want to approximate, if you know how to approximate all tensor networks up to that level of approximation, that's a complete problem. But there are smaller problems that are from a completeness point of view, are a better thing. And one of them is approximating Jones polynomial at particular values, roots of unity, for instance. And that was originally seen by Friedman, Kataev, Larson, and Wang, and shown using TQFTs. And Aronoff and Arad did it sort of more, I guess, for a computer science audience who was fearful of these other results. And then there's a separate result that says the top polynomial at certain values is complete. The thing that made that also interesting was some of those values are not where there are unitaries involved. And so I think that makes sense maybe I'll say one more thing and then stop. And the one more thing to say is the following. If you ask yourself the naive question, which may be not so naive, you'd say, okay, well, I now don't understand what a quantum computer can do. I just want to do that with a regular computer. I want to do that classically. I want to become world famous by showing that quantum and classical computers are the same sort of, they have the same ability to do these things. So what would you want to do? You would want to start with some tensor network, and you'd want to derive a classical algorithm for computing its value. Right? And so, well, there was this bubbling, I don't know, that seemed important, so let me just try to do it. So if I'm bubbling from here to here, right, I know that that's some sort of linear map that goes from C to H tensor H. Well, you know, H tensor H is not so big. I can do that. I can just do that. Right? And now I go over and I bubble this one. And so this becomes, so I've now got a vector. Before I did that, I've got a vector in H tensor H. And now this is going to take the right copy of H and map it to another copy of H, so I could do that calculation. And so it sort of maybe appears that I could sort of do this classically. The trouble is, of course, that when I try to do the map, this map from H to H, the second map, which is on the second component, I have to keep track of everything that's going on here. And the dimension of this space, I'm just doing linear algebra, but the dimension of this space is squared. Yeah, it's a d squared, right? And at some point in this process, if I have the number of, let's call the edge open, if it's been crossed, it's sort of half in and half out of the bubble. If I count up the number of edges that are open at any moment in the bubbling, it's the tensor product of that many copies of the space that I'm working on, right? And so if at some point the number of copies of the space is of size n, or approximately n, where n is basically the parameter of the input of the problem, the number of nodes or number of edges or something like that, then I'm working on a d to the n dimensional space. And now the problem, if I just want to do that linear operation, that's going to take too long because I'm trying to do linear algebra on a d to the n dimensional space. It's not, I can't do that in polynomial time. But that does say something about if I never get to that point, if I can bubble in some way so that I never have open too many edges, then indeed I can do it classically. Right? Then if the tensor network looks like this, let's just say it's a lattice like this, right, directly across, like that, all the way across. Right? If I bubble by swallowing here and then swallowing here and swallowing here, at any one time I only have three things that are open, or four maybe, once I bubble this out to here. Right? I have four, and then I bubble to here, and I still have four open, and then I bubble to here, then I have three open. So it goes from four to three to four to three, four to four to three. Well, then I can actually do this classically. Right? Because I'm only doing linear algebra on H tensor, H tensor, H tensor, possibly one more H. And that I can do perfectly fine. I'm perfectly fine simulate it classically. So there's some notion in which the geometry and the choice of bubbling of this thing somehow, the geometry of the, let's call it sort of a circuit, this tensor network, you know, certain things are there's sort of a continuum between, continuum is not the right word, but there's sort of in the same picture you can have the things that you can do classically and things that you can see you can't do classically by this naive way. So I think I'll stop there because my time is almost up, and I'm hoping to get somebody to say something good about something. In response. So. If somebody asks a question, I'll have to give you a quiz. So.